I'm Alexander Freund, and I'm interviewing Professor Pablo Pozzi, Chair in American History at the University of Buenos Aires, Argentina. Mm-hmm. And we are here at the 5th Oral History Conference of the South Brazilian Oral History Association. Today is the 27th of May, 2009, and we are in Marechal Candido Rondon in South Brazil. And this is an interview for the Oral History Forum d'Histoire Orale. So, first of all, thanks for agreeing to do the interview.
My pleasure.
And maybe we can just start, if you could just tell us how you came to oral history.
Okay. Small correction. I don't hold a chair in American history. I hold a chair in United States of America history. For the rest of us Latin Americans, in spite of our colleagues from the United States, the adscription of America only to them kind of rankles. For us, America, the chair in American history, which we have one, is the chair in Latin American history. Or it even includes some Canadian stuff there. I do a lot of things. I hold a chair on U.S. history. I head today the oral history program at the University of Buenos Aires. I've done for many, many years labor history in Argentina. I teach the Argentine Labor History Seminar, PhD seminar. My original research for my PhD was on labor and the 1976 dictatorship, 76 to 83 dictatorship. I was doing the research in the 1980s. This was a sizable problem for a researcher. I mean, the problem was that there were no police files. I could infer a whole bunch of things from available documentation, from newspapers, from flyers that we could find and stuff, but I couldn't really find out what was going on inside factories, and I was not interested in just recording general labor activity. I was interested in recalling how life had been in the factory, how people had reacted, what they had done, if anything. In these terms, the general conception at the time was that there had been passivity within labor after a very heady 20 years of very high level of struggle in terms of the labor movement. This made no sense to me. So I didn't know beans about labor history, oral history. This is 1985. I didn't know anything about labor oral history in Argentina at the time. Many words oral history was very frowned upon. I mean, you didn't get involved in this kind of stuff. That kind of stuff was, if they were being nice, they said you were doing politics. If they were being not nice, they were saying that you were just wasting your time and were not a serious historian at all. Serious historians dealt with documentation, papers, archives, and that kind of stuff, and not with this kind of subjective junk as memory, remembrances, and stuff like that. But I needed to solve my dissertation problem. I had these huge gaps in the research. And more than gaps in the research, I need to confirm a series of things that I had documentation for, but I didn't really have enough to be able to be serious about it. So what I did is I grabbed the tape recorder and started running along factories in the greater Buenos Aires area and said, "Hello, I'm a historian. Oh, that's nice. Tell me, what was the dictatorship how was life under the dictatorship in your factory?" And they would say, "Well, nothing ever happened. It was fine." And I would say, "Oh, it was fine. This is really interesting." I mean, my favorite interview, a guy called Don Lolo. Don Lolo is a graphic worker. He's a boiler. He runs the boiler in one of the biggest factories in Argentina. He used to have 12,000 workers inside it. It was a huge print work. Don Lolo is an old Italian guy with a huge mustache, very serious, very. And he's called Don because he has he's a craftsman, and his co-workers respect him. I mean, Don is not something that is granted to just anybody. It's a title of respect. And Don Lolo was he didn't believe in unions. He hated unions, but he joined a union. He would insist that they were just working people and didn't do anything, and they would not get in trouble because they were working people. So at some point, I tired of so many working people. I started asking him. I said, "Well, you have the biggest printing plant in the nation. Were there any flyers there?" "Oh yeah," he said. The Radical Party would bring a flyer. The Communist Party would bring a flyer. The Peronist Party would bring a flyer. I would say to some of them, "You join my party, I join your party." I said, "Well, this is in the middle of a dictatorship. They're chasing all you guys around. You guys, political activity is forgiven. It's forbidden. You knew who was a communist. You knew who was, "Oh, yeah," he said. "We're all a big family. But you never did anything against the dictators. Never. We're really honest people. We're working people." "Oh, yeah," we said. "Well, remember that the day somebody put a communist flag on top of the water tower?" And said, "Who did that?" "Well, I don't know." We said, "Ha, ha, ha, ha." It turned out eventually, after a long interview and a whole series of questions where you had to cajole, edge him into things, because he was very interested in pointing out that he was not a militant, that he was an average person who did not want to get into trouble, who was interested in work. He was not a troublemaker, and he was a serious person. Turned out in 1978, in the middle of this dictatorship, people disappearing right and left, this guy had stopped the factory. He had a 48-hour strike in the middle of the place because they changed the moment that you punch in into the factory. He had to change his clothes in his own time and not in the factory standing. He had to come in changed. This was a 15-minute difference, and he decided that this was unacceptable. Absolutely unacceptable, and he had to teach the younger workers that this was unacceptable. So he turned off his boiler, got up and said, "I don't know what you guys are going to do, but I am walking out of here." And he left. And it was a huge mess, and the military governor of the factory, a lieutenant colonel that was running the factory, almost was arrested by the dictatorship for permitting this kind of stuff, and they won. And I knew some of this stuff from the newspapers, because the second day of the strike, they had mentioned that there had been a strike. There had been another strike, labor activity. But I didn't know shit about this, what kind of labor activity. I quantified. I said, "Well, labor activity." And all of a sudden, this guy, and then I talked to other workers, made it come alive. Now, in this process, I did what every supposedly good historian, I'm not one, but okay, is supposed to do in this kind of stuff. You're doing interviews, so I decided to start reading every textbook and every book on oral history so I could do it well. Well, the first thing I found out that is really interesting, that we all write very well, but they're really not very useful, at least not in my context. I discovered things such as interviewing people and somebody walking in and contributing to the interview. And I didn't know who the person was, or another worker saying, I said, "Well, what happened in such and such a time?" He said, "Ah, John can tell you better. John, come on in here." And John would contribute and leave. Who the hell is John? Mm-hmm. What's happening here? And not every interview was contaminated, evidently, but they were all very rich. Another thing I had to deal with was labor and gender in Argentina, which I had not considered from the interview point of view. I mean, here I was sitting in somebody's home interviewing the male worker who was the important activist in the family, and he would talk, and all of a sudden the wife would walk by and say, "Don't lie to him, tell him the truth," and leave. Okay, and this was not so, and she would say, "Yes, dear," and again, you had to deal with these contributions, which were really important in terms of later trying to analyze things. My other problem was dealing with my own prejudice. Again, most of the textbooks I read didn't deal with that. And I've had those problems from then onwards. After doing this stuff on the dictatorship, I did a lot of stuff on activism, militancy, right-wing and left-wing, armed guerrilla groups and right-wing neo-fascist groups in Argentina. And dealing with these guys, it meant that I had to question a lot of preconceptions I had, which were, for me, reasonable, commonly held, let me give you, for instance, one day these guys from an organization called the Iron Guard came and said, well, all you Reds, I was the Red, keep interviewing all these commies. You never interview us. I said, okay, well, let's interview you. So I read up on the Iron Guard. The Iron Guard was a cadre organization with democratic centralism. Now, what the hell does this suggest to you? Leninism, right? I mean, this is clearly Leninist group. So I, Leninist organization, right wing, but Leninist group. So I started my interview and said, well, tell me something. Who was your secretary general? And the guy stopped and said, secretary general? You think about commander-in-chief. I said, okay. And your cells, how were they organized? Cells, the guy said. You mean our commandos? Yeah. And did you have a central committee? Central committee? You mean a ruling body? Yeah. I thought you were a cadre organization. We certainly were. Were you right wing? For me, they were extreme right. I mean, Romanian Iron Guard, that's where they got their name from. I said, no, we're not right wing at all. I said, so where did you get this name from? The Romanian Iron Guard. But they were fascists, I said. They were fascist to you, he said. So, listen, I could make it long, but listen, it became a really interesting interview where at some point, I had been an activist in my youth, at some point the guy was really frustrated, and so was I. Okay, because we couldn't seem to, we didn't talk the same language. Okay, so at some point the guy stops the interview and says, well, in 1973 I would have taken a chain and broken your head. Hell, here, you're doing an interview, a serious interview. What do you say to this? So I was frustrated too. I was angry too. And I said, well, in 1973 I would have taken a gun and blown your head off. And the guy looked at me and said, hey, you're all right. Let's start again. And it became a wonderful interview. But from something that that was not kosher, that was not supposed to be done. I mean, I had threatened my interviewee. It was really shameful. I shouldn't do that kind of stuff. And yet, by doing that kind of stuff, I had somehow earned respect, trust, and empathy. I mean, all of a sudden, he was not talking to a remote historian. He was talking to a fellow militant from a different organization, an enemy, ultimately, but somebody that shared similar experiences so that we could talk. Now, I don't know how to deal with this kind of stuff. I mean, this was a couple of years ago, from 1985 to a couple of years ago. It's been a long time, but these things keep happening again and again and again. And it's fun. It's lots of fun, but it's hard to deal with. Sorry, I was too long. I talk a lot.
Oh, no, I'm just checking the level.
Okay. All right. So back in 85, there were very, very few people of us doing oral history in Argentina. Most of us were doing it for the same reason. We were interested in specific kind of research, and if somebody didn't tell us about it, there was nowhere we could access initially information. Once we decided that information was important, I'm one of the kind of people who thinks that yes, an interview gives you information you can check, hard data. It also gives you a lot of really wonderful information you cannot check, subjective information, which is as important, sometimes more important than the other one, but that I hadn't considered. I mean, being trained in von Ranke and positivism and all that kind of stuff, this stuff never made it into my horizon. And at the time there were four or five of us. There was a guy called Ernesto Salas. He was doing Peronist resistance. He was doing a really important strike on the Peronist resistance because he's a Peronist. He still is today. I don't know why, but still is. And for him, it was oral history was, again, like in my case, an awakening. He discovered that in the key moment of Peronism, this key huge strike for Peronism, the strike of the Lisandro de la Torre Meat Works, the communists had been crucial. And he was very anti-communist. And how could he accept the fact that the communists were really important in the key historical moment for his political movement? So this opened his head. There were two colleagues who were doing the oral history of the University of Buenos Aires, intellectual history mostly. They came to that because the University of Buenos Aires decided to begin financing its own history somehow, and this was one of the few ways that you could do it. And then there was Dora Schwarzstein. Dora was an Argentine who was doing Spanish Republican exiles in Argentina mostly. And she was probably the only one of us who started out more or less having an idea what the hell oral history was. She was the one who later on set up the oral history program at the University of Buenos Aires, and she died about 7-8 years ago, which time I succeeded her in the post. But in mid-1980s, doing any kind of oral history in Argentina was kind of like something that you really had to think about before you put it on your resume. Because all my colleagues would consider that this was not something that you said in public, that it was not really serious historians. I mean, I still remember today being introduced one day by a colleague as a political scientist. I said, I'm not a political scientist. They said, oh, I thought you were. You spent all your time on that kind of stuff. That kind of stuff was oral history, so it's really interesting. From then onwards, we've gained some ground. In some cases, not much recognition. I mean, most of my colleagues are uncomfortable with oral history. They're uncomfortable for many reasons. They're uncomfortable because of this neo-positivist training. They're also uncomfortable because it empowers people. I mean, you again, oral history is very subversive, or it can be if you want it to be. I mean, sometimes it can be very boring, and some people are very boring doing oral history. But it can be very subversive in the sense that you again can put people in the center of history and change focuses from the bottom up and challenge preconceived notions and ideas and really question things you thought you were doing well, methodology, theories, interpretation, and stuff. For my Marxist colleagues, I'm a postmodern freak. For my postmodern freaks, for my postmodern freak colleagues, I'm a Marxist weirdo. I really don't give a damn. I am enjoying myself in what I'm doing. I think I'm making a contribution, small, but contribution. And what we've done from that is more or less build oral history, which has grown quite a bit, especially since about 1998-99. We have a national conference every 2 years. The first one was in 95. The first one was well attended, but all right. The last one 2 years ago was very well attended. I mean, we're talking about 200 papers easily and over 1,500 people in terms of audience. We've managed to build that, and in this sense, if I can blow my own horn, we've done a good job in terms of, and the university has been important. We've joined people from an academic setting, us, some people from the University of Rosario, and some people from a couple of other universities, with people from high schools, high school teachers, even high school students, from townships, historical institutes in townships. Every township in Argentina has a historical institute that does the local history. Most of these guys that deal with when the town was founded and that kind of stuff. And we've succeeded in the last 10 years or so in getting these people involved in projects in terms of from migrants to the area, when did they arrive and how, to culture in the area, to, for me, more fun stuff, to, I don't know, how did the township live in the dictatorship, or small town, Chivilcoy. Chivilcoy in Argentina was one of the four towns that commemorated the first May 1st in 1890. What do people know about it? Do they remember this stuff? I mean, why the hell would this small dinky town in rural Argentina have this stuff? Or something that my wife does, which is even more fun. In 1928, this small rural town, 3,000 people in the Pampas in Cordoba, is the first communist township in America. Now, why are these rural peons winning? I mean, they won an election. Mm-hmm. They won an election, they won the township, they got the mayor, they raised the red flag in the central square, they redistributed, well, they did all sorts of fun things. Now, in a traditional area of Argentina, very Catholic, very nationalistic, this is a rural area, the only workers are rural workers, peons. Why does this happen? What do people remember of this kind of stuff? Do they remember anything or nothing? They remember nothing, really. So it's in a sense, all these people are doing this type of thing. My wife is a high school teacher.
What's her name?
Mariana. And who's now doing her PhD. And on this stuff, which is nice. It joins also with something called memory commissions. Many neighborhoods and townships, as a result of the dictatorship, have neighbors and average people who get together to more or less rediscover what happened in the area. So-and-so has disappeared. Why? Who was he? Who was she? What happened? When? Where did they go? Did they go anywhere? And they set up plaques and plazas, and they write little pamphlets, remember this kind of stuff. And we've managed to get these people to come into this oral history environment as a whole and join these our conference. Part of the well, we have unions participate in this stuff. One of the things we do a lot from the oral history program at the University of Buenos Aires is collaborate with unions. This means that labor groups or unions themselves come to us and says, we'd like to do the history of the union. So we provide one or two people who will advise them and help them set up a group of, I don't know, five, six, seven workers who will actually do the history. They will do the research and they will do the writing and they will decide what they have to do and how. And we provide two things. We provide technical know-how, how we solve this thing, and we also provide something that nobody really measures. If we're not there, they don't get together. Okay, we provide legitimacy somehow. And we've done this with dock workers and with the university workers and with steel workers and with auto workers and with all sorts of different people. The oral history program also works well. And these kind of people we bring into the conference and the stuff. So eventually what happens is that there is, they slowly begin building a field once you started gathering all these people. Eventually we set up a national association, which is headed right now by the president of the Buenos Aires Historical Institute, which is not an academic institute. It's a municipal institute. And for us, this was important because, on the one hand, she is not an academic. And on the other hand, she is. Okay? It's a non-academic in a traditional sense. So, in this sense...
What's her name?
Liliana Varela.
And do you know how many members the association has?
Exactly right now, not really, but it's easily over 100. Easily. I mean, there's in the oral history program, there's 37 of us, and we're all members. So it's I don't know, a couple hundred.
And this is the major oral history program in the country.
The ours? Yeah, easily. Yeah, yeah. And major oral history program in the biggest university, the more prestigious university. The University of Buenos Aires is a national public university. We got 350,000 students. Our university organized along the lines of schools, faculties, okay? The program is in the Faculty of Philosophy and Letters, and the faculties are organized by departments. The departments are discipline-oriented, and the students join a discipline, and they study a discipline from beginning to end. In other words, they come into history, and they do 5 years of history, and they come out as a licenciado or a profesor in history. This means, in our case, that we have about 4,000 students in the history department. My chair, U.S. History, which is at the end of this stuff, has about 200 students in it regularly. Okay, they tend to be older students. Most people study, I mean, there's a whole bunch of younger students who study history because right at high school. And there's a whole bunch of older people who study history as a second career. I mean, they're not that interested in becoming historians, or they are, but not necessarily practicing. They always liked history. They always wanted to be historians, but they're really bank tellers or I don't know, computer scientists or some such garbage like that. I mean, see, this is my prejudice for real. And this means that you have a pretty interesting mix in the classroom of I don't know, 20-year-olds and 50-year-olds who contribute different things to the classroom. It's hard teaching. It's tough teaching. It's much easier to teach in the States where they're all right at high school and no shit. excuse my French. So, yeah.
You mentioned earlier your sort of frustration with the oral history manuals and instruction on how to do an interview. In the meantime, have Argentinian oral historians developed some sort of a common approach to oral history interviewing? So some sort of a consensus? Are there new manuals?
No.
Or is everyone doing sort of...
No. We've managed to no. The simple answer is no. We're finding our way, okay, and we're discussing different things. Part of the problem is trying to get straight within this heterogeneous world of oral history. What the hell is oral history and what's it for? Right now we have people doing oral history in what could be perceived as a more academic European or Canadian sense. In this case, we have people who do oral history and really journalists, ultimately. We have people who are not doing really oral history or journalism, they're doing gossiping, really. I mean, and so there's a variety of this kind of stuff. I mean, there's this an example of how complex how messy this kind of stuff is. In the last oral history conference, we had a person who decided to present a paper where he interviewed himself. Now this is really interesting because he would you know, play the tape and and he would preface each thing. So I asked and I answered with kind of things. All right, this is and it was kind of mind boggling. A lot of people present thought it was cute. I thought it was ridiculous, but you know. So we're trying to see how we deal. I mean, there's part of the problem also is dealing, discussing on a more serious level a bunch of other things, such as they run from technical matters, taping or filming, okay, which underlie bigger discussions, cultural discussions. I don't film not only because it's more expensive to film, which contributes, but also because in Argentine society, everybody expects their 15 minutes of television. And it's really, 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 really hard, at least for me, to get people to, when I am filming them, to get them to ignore the camera, relax sufficiently, develop empathy and a bonding, whereas they're not trying to act for the camera and try to access their memories, remembrances, and be spontaneous. So I don't like it. Other people really like it because they say it shows body language and stuff. Again, I disagree. I don't think it shows body language. I think it shows a pose that people pose for that in our culture, okay? I mean, but again, am I right or they right? I don't know. Whatever works for you is fine by me. What I do try and demand is that you be conscious of the problems dealing with that kind of stuff. The other kind of problems, more in depth, is dealing with certain nuances which we usually, and in manuals, are not taken into account. From how to phrase questions to how to relate to your interviewee person to analysis and on and on. What we're trying to discuss now and trying to get straight for most of the people is that oral history is not only just anything, and at least in our case at the University of Buenos Aires, we insist that we're not oral historians. We're historians, period. We refuse to be sent to a ghetto, okay? We're historians. We're serious historians who do oral history, which is a different thing. Mm-hmm. In other words, we don't want a niche. We want to discuss and dispute with the establishment how history is made, and we think oral history could make a good contribution and change the way we think about history and the way we do history. This implies not only issues in terms of methodology and in theory, but also implies that every project, like any good historical project, can be specific and particular, but we have to make the linkages so it says something about historical process. Mm-hmm. Right now, this is kind of embryonary, so that some of the stuff is kind of forced. Okay, I mean, not every project says anything about history or historical process. It's not true. We'd like it to, but it doesn't. But if we force people to think about how the interview of a single worker in southern Buenos Aires, Don Lolo, can say something about the working movement or the labor movement at the time, then perhaps Don Lolo doesn't say a thing about this kind of stuff, but we will think of ways to try and access the bigger picture, all right, through what are subjectivity contributions by our specific interviewees. Again, this is, we're thinking about it. We got a lot of questions, not that many answers. But for us, I think it's important. In other words, I did a large study, I mean 10 years, where I interviewed about 100 former guerrillas, and then I went, of one group, the People's Revolutionary Army, and then I interviewed some Peronist guerrillas to see what they would say about these other guys, and then I interviewed military officers and trade union leaders, what they said about these guys, and then I went into neighborhoods. I chose 5 neighborhoods in Argentina, where these guys had worked, had activated. And I rang doorbells and said, hello, I am working about, I don't know what to say, if I should say, I'm studying terrorism, subversion, guerrillas. Any word I used was loaded, okay, and would condition the response. So I alternated between subversives and guerrillas and see what would happen. And a lot of neighbors talked to me and told me things. And on the one hand, this was fun. I found out a lot of stuff about guerrillas and data and why would they get involved in this stuff. But I thought that this was though this was really fun, it was much more interesting in terms of how it made me rethink about Argentine history. And though this has not had much of an impact in terms of the profession per se, it has had some impact in terms of younger historians, in terms of challenging their conceptions. Not necessarily the way I would like. They're not saying Pablo Posey is right. they might be saying Pablo Posey's full of shit, which is likely, but it means that they have to think about it and justify this stuff. For instance, Peronism. Peronism is a populist movement. Was Peronism McCarthyite? Yes or no? Well, no. Not according to these guys. 40-some-odd% of these guys in these guerrilla in this guerrilla movement, which is Marxist, Leninist, anti-Peronist, come from Peronist families. What the hell are they doing there? People perceptions of democracy. Democracy's elections? No. Only in official history. Okay, non-regular people. For me, the 1976 coup in Argentina was a shock. Hell, 30,000 people disappeared, thousands were killed, hundreds exiled. I don't know, people went to jail and stuff. Terrible. I kept asking these people. The dictatorship was bad. And they would say, yeah, it was really terrible. Really persecuted people and this and that. I said, yes, General Videla, the guy who did the coup in 76, was terrible. I said, Videla? No, not Videla. Aramburu, the guy who did the 1955 coup. And he would say, no, what do you mean the 55? No, the 55 coup, that was really bad. I said, no, the 76. Oh, yeah, that one too. Okay, for them, it was like what, for me, middle-class university professor was a watershed in history because middle class had been very affected in 1976 coup. Was not the same true for workers. Workers had been, what they were telling me basically is that from 1955 onwards, they had a tough time. And that, yeah, the coup in 76 was bad. Well, I mean, it wasn't good, but it wasn't worse than all the other coups. And their standard of living had gone down since 55. And here I was, sitting with my tape recorder in one hand and my history textbook on the other, and I said, and how do I deal with this? Mm-hmm. How do I explain this to my colleagues who are not going to like to hear this? Mm-hmm. Because it means that they will have to rewrite most of the history books.
And have they?
No.
Do you expect them to?
Nah. No. No, I don't know. I don't have any imperial ambitions, okay? What I would really, really like is for history in Argentina to be more critical.
More critical?
More critical, more thoughtful. Again, it might be more critical and thoughtful in ways I don't agree with or I don't like, but less uniform, less colorless, where we all say the same type of thing. It's very boring. We have to answer a basic question. Most people in Argentina read history. Most people in Argentina love history. Most people read history written by journalists, not by historians. Why? Well, one of the answers, I always thought because people liked something simple and accessible and a nice story. Except that my book on the guerrillas has gone through 4 printings and was a bestseller for a month. And my book on the labor and the dictatorship had a small impact in academia, but I can walk into any labor union in Argentina, anyone. Right, left, center, up, Trotskyist or Peronist, and they will know who I am. Mm. Now, this is neat. This is good for my ego, but it also says something in terms of subjects and approaches. I have, when I was doing the stuff on the guerrillas, I had found this former guerrilla from northern Argentina. He was an hachero. An hachero is a woodcutter, which is the poorest of sector of Argentine labor. And he was of Indian blood, of American Indian blood. And here was, I mean, and he had been condecorated. He had been given a medal by the guerrilla for mass work, for organizing people, which is astounding. I mean, here was my perception of guerrillas, only people, you know, firing shots, and he was this guy who was okay? Organizer, heavy organizer. And I wanted this guy to tell me his story of his life, okay? And here we were sitting in a bar in Buenos Aires, and I was trying to get this guy to tell me his story of his life, and I was trying to invent things and convince him, and I would have done anything, sell him my mother if he wanted to. I wanted this story more than anything. And the guy would just stare at me. He wouldn't say a word. And I would keep saying, another coffee? Would you like some gin? Have a beer? Okay, anything. Then I eventually lost hope. I lost hope. And he said, well, okay, we're not going to talk. We're not going to talk. And all of a sudden he kind of woke up and he said, well, what was your name? I mean, I had been talking for 45 minutes and didn't even know what my name was. It was wonderful. I said, well, I'm Pablo Pozzi. I says, ah, yeah, he says, you're the guy that wrote that book on labor and the dictatorship. Yeah. He says, yeah, that blue cover, I remember. It was an interesting book. We can talk. And I felt like Hobsbawm. Especially because if you pay attention, he didn't say it was a good book. He didn't say that he agreed with the book. He said it was interesting, which meant a lot of things. I mean, his choice of words was really interesting. It meant that he didn't agree with it, but that he felt he could trust me as a result of something I'd done, that he could talk to me, that I would listen with understanding, not with sympathy. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I thought, gee, this is what being a historian is all about. Mm-hmm. And oral history permits that. That's what allows it, okay? It goes beyond your average thing. We say it returns a social function to the historian. People don't read us because we've lost our social function. Mm-hmm. We've lost our readership for 150 years, was the population at large. Our readership today are other academics, except in oral history. Average people love to read the stuff we do in oral history. Okay? They love it. They love it. They really, really enjoy it. Studs Terkel is probably the best known historian in the United States. I don't think anybody in academia would say that Studs Terkel is a historian, and yet the average person in the street would say that he is the historian. Mm-hmm. Now, this says a lot. Mm-hmm. It says a lot about us. So I think, oral history is subversive because it empowers people, puts them back in the center of history. I also think it's subversive because it empowers us again. It makes us useful, noticeable. It links us to society again. It returns it to the historian an objective that is the reason why I studied history. Hell, there's no money, there's no power, and there's no prestige in history. The only power there is the power to flunk your students. So come on, money. There's a little bit of money, but if you really want to get money, be a lawyer, be an accountant, be a doctor. Don't be a historian. This is silly. Okay. Prestige, even less and less and less. People think in terms of historical prestige, most people have, a doctor or a lawyer have more prestige than we have, easily. So why the hell become a historian? Because you can make a difference. And you can make a difference with oral history.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you can, we're sort of running out of time, but I want to see if you could place the development of oral history in Argentina in the larger context of Latin America, South America.
Okay.
The connections to other countries, and I guess what I'm also wondering whether there's sort of a more unified approach or development in Latin America.
Okay. The easy answer is no. Okay. The more complex answer is, the development of oral history throughout Latin America is very varied and very different. It has a long and very important tradition in Mexico, very important tradition, dating back to the late 60s, early 70s. It has a very good tradition in Brazil. Comparatively, Argentines are fairly newcomers to this kind of stuff. It's relatively non-existent in places like Paraguay and Uruguay. It's very new in places like Venezuela. In Central America, there's almost none, no matter what the Nicaraguans say. In Chile, there's a little bit more, especially because historians and history has good development there, but it's very unorganized. At least that's my impression. So part of the ideas, basically what I was interested in, why I accepted getting involved with the International Association, which I've never been involved before, mostly because, hell, I got a lot of stuff to do. Okay, I have enough infighting in Argentina not to have infighting on an international level, and I really don't care if I don't know, so-and-so invites me to their country. I travel a lot already, okay? I mean, academic tourism is fine, but I can do my own, all right? I think the association can contribute, and this is what we're trying to do, basically to help link and support development in different countries. The way to do this is...
You're now speaking about the International Oral History Association.
Yeah, the IOHA, yeah, very much. Which is, I mean, I'm here now not only talk to Alexander Freund, but also basically to get together with Antonio Montenegro and to see how a series of initiatives we're trying to develop in Latin America can be fostered and developed. Initiatives such as joint projects. Here in Marechal Cândido Rondón, we've done a two-year project with people, three people from Rondon, three people from the University of Buenos Aires, on oral history and social movements, migrations, frontier work and stuff. The basic idea, the model that we worked with was that these people set up the project and they decide basically the characteristics of the project. My commitment at the University of Buenos Aires is to publish the book. They're supposed to produce a book at the end of 2 years, whereas in the first year they will gather in Argentina or in Cândido Rondón to discuss papers or the structure, what they're writing together. They have to decide, or the interviews or whatever the hell they're doing. I mean, it's not my decision, it's theirs, okay? Their problem is to have something good enough to be published. In other words, they got to get their act together. The second year they meet in the other country to more or less finalize this stuff. It's supposed to have a good discussion, a good level, and then when it goes for publication eventually, will be refereed and whatever else it's done. My focus is to try and have the people that participate in these projects tend to be younger scholars, rather than older scholars, because I want to build on the long term. I'm not trying to exclude the older scholars, on the contrary, but if I have a choice, I would much prefer include the younger people so that the three other Argentines at this conference here today are the people in that project.
And are there lots of sort of those international cooperations within South America going on?
No.
Or is this sort of the story?
No, I mean, there's one, two with Brazil, one with Mexico, with Gerardo Necochea, which the book we finished now on militancy, and we've gathered Mexicans, Brazilians, Marieta de Moraes, Gerardo Necochea and Patricia Pensado, Gilma Romero in Nicaragua, and myself in Argentina. Hard work. We love different criteria, tough stuff. But we finished now, basically. I have an ongoing work group with Chile, with the Labor Museum in Chile. And my basic idea is to try and, what we were discussing with Antonio, is try and set up a couple of more. We have a saying in Spanish, el que mucho abarca, poco aprieta. He who grabs too much presses too little. Okay, so that we are building from the small to the larger stuff, slowly and trying to learn from experience. If these work teams have good results, this will encourage other teams to do this kind of stuff. At the same time, I'm trying to see whether, well, and we're pushing for this from the Latin American end of the international. I mean, for the locals, the name of the University of Buenos Aires is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Now, if we can have the University of Buenos Aires plus the Yohai, it's even better. Mm-hmm. Okay, it doesn't cost Yohai anything. It doesn't do anything, but it's but it makes a difference. Mm-hmm. Eventually, what I'm trying to do also is to have. We've done it. Change a few things. Have Yohai sponsor local events, so that again, it doesn't cost Yohai a cent, but it gives it a grassroots presence that it didn't have. Hell, I don't want to be offensive. We have more members in the National Association of Argentina than all of the international. Mm-hmm. So hey, let's stop the bullshit, okay? And let's be good oral historians and take oral history to the hustings, all right? Let's take it to the masses somehow. So let's link. Let's link the international to the local movements, which will encourage local movements to develop, which will help to internationalize local movements, so that we're having Pilar Dominguez Prats coming to Argentina in October and give the opening speech.
Who's currently the president of the International Oral History Association?
She is the president.
For all readers.
Oh, sorry. She is the president. You're right. We're having a conference in Venezuela, in Valencia, Carabobo, in October, late October also, where Antonio and myself are going. Again, Yohai's present. I represented Yohai at this conference. It's more than just creating a rubber stamp. Mm. All right? It generates linkages, networks, legitimacy, and it encourages people to do this. Having Alexander Freund give a conference at this conference all of a sudden opens new vistas to the locals in terms of what can be done and how with oral history, suggests things. I think we should do more of this kind of stuff. I think we should exchange practices in terms of oral history. I think we should leave the infighting for some other time. Or you can do it, but I'm not interested. And I think we should take advantage of the fact that oral history for many, 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 many people, not necessarily or not mostly in academe, is really interesting and heady. Mm-hmm. So let's take history out of the ivory tower. Mm-hmm. Why not? Keep the advantages of the ivory tower. Let's be serious historians. I mean, I'm not a populist, okay? I'm passionate, not silly, which is a different thing. And let's take it out. And people really are eager. My main problem with... I relate a lot to neighborhood groups and as an oral historian. Labor groups and activist groups, political groups also. My main problem is that they always ask me the same question. How come more of us don't relate to them? Mm-hmm. And I never have a good answer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the answer that one could give is that we really don't care. It's not a good answer.
Mm-hmm. That's probably true in most cases.
It's probably true, but it's not a good answer.
Yeah. I just wanted to briefly come back to the international perspective. Sure. Outside of Yohai, how do you see how Argentinian and more broadly South American, Latin American oral history has been received, perceived by the international or other countries?
Latin American community.
Yeah.
It varies again. Yeah. Most of us have the same problem everywhere. Whereas the historical establishment doesn't accept oral history as something viable or even scientific or even serious or even anything within the discipline. And again, it changes depending the country and reality. Chileans better, Venezuelans probably worse, or as bad, or as some of the others. So it comes and goes. Okay.
And how has oral history that is done in South America been received or perceived by, let's say,
elsewhere?
North America.
I don't think they're even aware we exist. I mean, let's be serious. Part of what the international should do is make us aware of what's done in other areas. Hell, we have a saying in Latin America: when Washington gets a cold, we get pneumonia, which is reasonable. But I mean, we read you guys; you don't read us. You don't read us from the one hand because you guys think we have nothing to say. On the other hand, we agree, and we think that nothing that we can say can even come close to what anything that Hobsbawm said. All right. So that it's a funny thing. Once Perry Anderson came down to Argentina and told us Argentines how we should struggle for democratic rights. I was the only guy who got up in the middle of the conference and left. I thought this was silly. I thought it was cheeky bastard, pedantic ass. Mm. I mean, how would he like it if I went to London and gave a conference in the New School, told the Brits how they should struggle for democracy? He would probably kick me out of England. Really? I mean, who the hell are you, fella? Mm-hmm. All right? Why should I take this kind of crap? I mean, this is disrespectful.
So this is more than a simple lack of translation.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of stuff in Latin America translated. How much have you read?
Nothing.
Thank you. All right.
Let
me put it the other way.
Outside of oral history.
Yeah, let me put it this way on the other hand. I mean, you asked me before this interview, how many labor historians in Canada did I know? Mm-hmm. I could mention 5. How many labor historians in Latin America do you know? Mm-hmm. Can't mention one. Thank you. Now you're doing fine now. You're doing very well. I'm not complaining. Mm-hmm. This is reasonable and it's the way things are. But I think that we could probably have a richer field of history by exchanging more stuff. One of the things that we are starting in Latin America trying to do is to try and discuss things amongst ourselves, such as, is there such a thing as Latin American oral history? I don't think there is. Okay, I think there, to be simple, what I think there are different questions and methodologies that come from specific realities. A different thing to interview a Guarani aborigine in southern Brazil or northern Argentina than it is to interview your German immigrants in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And you have to do these different techniques in terms of how you approach. Questions are different. How you relate. Most of the stuff I do with Argentine workers would probably rankle or not sound quite right to many of my colleagues in Europe. Necessarily, our language would be more politicized. Okay, most of my people would think that the average language expressions that many oral historians use elsewhere as neutral are just stupid. Hmm. All right, they expect you to have a strong political point of view. Now, how do you deal with this without tainting or poisoning your whole interview? This is the interesting stuff that you have to discuss, plus a whole bunch of other different things. Most of my works are really sexist. Most of my workers speak with strong words. I mean, they're really foul-mouthed. Mm-hmm. What do they mean? How do you deal with that? This is part of culture. What the significance? So there are specific things, I think, that should be taken into account, and we're trying to move on and discuss some of this stuff slowly, again. But I'm an enthusiast, so I think it can be done.
Yeah.
I would rather do it through the International Association, because if there's an association that already has the linkages, why the hell do something new? I mean, we don't have an invent gunpowder. Okay. If it can't be done, well, hell, we're going to do it anyways.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just a last question.
Yeah.
Because I know you have to run off.
Yeah.
Historians are not in the business of predicting the future, but
yeah,
nevertheless, we can sort of speculate of course and express wishes for the future. So where do you see oral history going in the various contexts of Argentina, South America?
No, I think it's at least in Latin America, it's growing significantly. In this sense, it's not necessarily the future in terms of funding, but it is in terms of changing the way we look at history and the historical field. In this sense, I don't expect it to either die or become something boring or restrictive. It will probably become more heterogeneous before it becomes more serious, to say, call it. Not serious. Serious is a poor word, especially for an oral historian. Bad word. Sorry. More with rules and regulations and stuff. Part of the growth of oral history today in South America is that it is dynamic because it's not restricted. Okay, so that anybody thinks they can get involved and do oral history, which is not true, but this permits us to connect to them and to try and organize that and then organize it somehow. Part of the problem and part of the discussion is Sean Field made a nice, wonderful piece that if I ever have time, I'd like to contribute to. Is oral history now part of the establishment or not? And this implies, what the hell is the establishment, and who defines the establishment? And I think that, well, the answer is easy: yes and no. Okay. Oral history can be part of the establishment, in other words, in the sense of boring, academic ease, ivory tower type of stuff, only if we want it to. In other words, it depends on whether you're a boring person, Alexander Freund, or not. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily because it has academic positions. Mm-hmm. I know wonderful historians who hold chairs at Yale. David Montgomery was one. Wonderful, who was probably a very interesting, passionate man throughout his life, and yet he held a chair at Yale. I wish I had held a chair at Yale. Okay, I know other people who apparently are public historians and are linked with society at large all the time, and yet they're nothing. They're very boring people. They don't feel history. History's alive and depends on what you make it. Mm-hmm. I think oral history is a key thing because it permits us to access this. It's one of the ways to do it. And I think the potential for oral history is to grow as long as it retains this characteristic. But this characteristic is not necessarily something intrinsic to oral history. We have to make it. I think, like in oral history, if the protagonist of oral history is the interviewer with the interviewee, what we make of oral history depends on the historian, not really on the discipline or the technique itself.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Wow, that sounded even serious. Gee whiz. Let's go.
Thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. Please.
And
okay.
I bet that our listeners, readers, will enjoy this interview.
I hope so.